Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Markowitz. We are leading you through the weekend edition. I also want to refocus everybody back on our website to all the daily editorials we did this week. It was a busy week and rightfully so. There was a lot of news to talk about. Plus, there's still a lot of news coming out of companies that we follow closely on the site. So please have a listen to those company interviews and please get in touch with us. Let us know your thoughts on the companies we're having on, the guests we're having on, and if there are any other topics you really want us to dive into. On this weekend show, we're going to focus a lot on the broad equity markets and also dabble a little bit in the metals. And we have to touch on the interest rate environment here where bonds continue to sell off, yields are rising. Shad and I are kicking off the show with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors. That's read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail side, he writes in The No Trader and a piece called 7-Eleven, where Rick picks no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs, all with the goal to beat the S&P. Rick, let's start with the S&P because it was 2 weeks ago that you came out to your subscribers saying that you were putting on some tactical shorts. And this last week, you outlined the scenario here where you think the S&P at best goes sideways for the remainder of the year. Summarize these kind of big picture thoughts for the S&P, please, Rick.
Thanks, Corey. Well, we did put on a tactical short, and obviously that provided some benefit for those who did put it on where we had suggested. But let's talk about the bigger picture here, which is whether or not the S&P, which has a high near, rough, I think it's about 45, 46, something like that, is the high. If with the rebound that we saw after Monday sell-off, you know, is not on the downside and then just turns around and goes and starts making new highs again, which several people on the street are looking for. I don't think so. And even if we did make new highs, I don't think it's a melt up. I think it would be a very minimal incremental new high that would come back off. What I'm actually thinking, and this has been a change in thought over, you know, let's say from where I was a month ago, is that between now and year's end, we mostly go sideways. And again, a minor new high doesn't really do anything to change that idea. I don't think that we crush it. I'm in total disagreement for those companies on the street that think we're going 15 and 20% lower. I don't think that's likely. Do I see a 5 to maybe 10%? I think that's possible. And I don't think we go more than a few percent higher from here either. One of the biggest reasons I think that actually comes off of the charts, and I almost wish there was a way that we could put this out for you know, radio listeners, but I'll walk you through this so that you kind of understand what makes me think that we've hit a fairly important inflection point. If you look at where the S&P was back in 2007, in October 2007, we made all-time highs, and that was the high going into the great financial crisis that bottomed in March of 2009. A point loss on that decline in pure point terms, not percentage, but in pure point terms in the S&P was, I think, was just over 910 points, something like that. And if you take the 910 points and think of this, if you were looking at a chart and saw the all-time high in 07 down to the low in 09, a 100% retracement would bring you back to the 07 high, right? It, you know, sold off and then it recouped the entire sell-off. If recouping that sell-off was 100% of what the decline was, then when we went to 1.618 times what that sell-off was, we paused for 8 months in 2015. We literally hit that level, paused for 8 months, before eventually breaking out in the first half of 2016. And then we zipped up, and in late 2019, we hit the next level, which would have been 2.618 times. Why is that? Well, these are Fibonacci numbers, and these are naturally occurring phenomena that exist in nature, and they have been brought to the market years and years ago as being ways of also interpreting the ebbs and flows of the marketplace. And we scooted, we eventually went through that level into the early 2020 high, then we sold off into the March 2020 bottom, which almost sold off back to that 1.618 level, and then, you know, we turned around and shot higher. Well, if you take 2.618 and multiply that times 1.618, you come up with 4.24. And that measurement off of the 2009 low, meaning 4.24 times the decline in points from the 07-09 low added to the 09 low, in other words, 4.29 times that decline, gets you to S&P 4,522. That's roughly 20 S&P points off what is now the all-time high. So that was the high last month. That's the high this month. I would think that it's going to stay the high for the next several months with the chance of a pullback along the way, that if it happened this month and if we took out Monday's low, we could get all the way down to, I'd say, you know, 4,100 or something like that. If it happens next month, it's probably somewhere north of 4,100, but less than 4,200. And that's what I'm thinking, is that we are at a very natural place for the market to pause. The five equity strategists at tier one firms that in the last 2 weeks put out sell signals, I can virtually guarantee we're not looking at that to come up with it. They're fundamental analysts who look at the big picture and say the S&P is overpriced, yada, yada, yada. We're due for a significant decline. So I'm not in that significant decline camp, but I do think we're in a place that we could easily see the market pause for months, which is why I shifted into a probably sideways type mode into year's end, where we don't make any material gain or material loss, but there's still the chance for some pullback. But I really disagree with those who are looking for a major market decline. I don't think it's coming. I think there's too many positive things about the economy that would not have that occur. And you can virtually find plenty of strategists on the street who'll tell you that stocks are cheap versus those who'll tell you stocks are expensive. And which is why I personally only give virtually no credence to the strategists on the street, except I like to collectively look at what they're thinking. And I wrote in that very same report to clients that it is highly unlikely we sell off 15 to 20% from the highs, mostly because five tier one strategists think we would, and they made that call within 1% of what was currently the all-time high. In my 40 years on Wall Street, I have never seen five Wall Street strategists from big firms or small firms, doesn't matter, collectively come out within days of each other that the market was going to take a significant dive when we were within 1% of all-time highs. If anything, you see them typically saying we're going much higher. For them to say we're going much lower makes me really reduce the likelihood in my head that that is going to happen. So that's kind of what I see, guys.
That's an interesting take on it, Rick. And it's uncanny how those Fibonacci numbers often will trump some of the fundamental points of view that some of these analysts have. And yeah, when you have a consensus of everybody thinking it's going lower and they're all on one side of the boat, that is a caution alarm sometimes to think maybe it's a contrarian bet to look at the other side of things and maybe it won't be as severe as they're thinking. But I know that when you track the 7-Eleven report, you're looking at the 11 spider ETFs and looking for the seven that you think will outperform. Even in a sideways market, surely there is a few sectors you have your eyes on that you think may be a little more bullish than the others. Which ones have your eye and which ones do you think may outperform the other sectors, Rick?
So just about a month ago, I upgraded energy in that report and to clients who are, you know, institutional clients, suggesting that that would be a very good time to come back in and overweight energy. And we essentially caught the low of the underperformance that energy had had for several months. So it has outperformed nicely in the past 4 weeks. So that is the sector that I think will do well. And look, oil's pushing virtually near its highs. It's not quite there, but we're not so far away. So you still have oil in the 70s, and that's going to help the energy space. And then certainly I like financials. I upgraded those, I think it was in July, almost a month earlier than I, or maybe even June, upgraded energy. And we did so when rates had fallen down to 1.15%. So we virtually caught the low in that decline. Now, of course, today rates are near 1.45%, and they've had a significant move even in the last couple of days, finally breaking above resistance at between 1.4 and 1.42. So financials should outperform. One of the ones I'm concerned about is if rates continue higher here, which in general I think they will, I think technology, especially big cap tech, is going to have trouble materially outperforming. And therefore, I'm likely in the upcoming October 1st report to lower exposure to the tech sector, simply because growth names, especially growth tech names, have trouble when interest rates go up. The cost of funding is higher, and it's generally not a great environment for them. So we certainly can see financials be better leaders than they've been through, you know, over the last several years. And you know, they've recouped a fair amount of what they've pulled back from the highs this year. So I kind of, just off the bat, I think I favor energy and financials and will lower some exposure into tech. Take that away from being an overweight.
So Rick, is big picture here, one of the most important markets or sectors to watch the bond market, because yields have started to break out again. And it seems like with central bank policies really around the world leaning towards some form of tightening, that the path of least resistance is higher for rates, and that has repercussions for really every market?
Yeah, I think in general, the answer to that is yes. And you, an equity investor always has to look at the bond market. It's historically known as the smarter money. In other words, the bond market figures out what's going to happen often before the equity market does. And if this move in yields is real, and you know, right now the TNX is trading as we record this late Friday afternoon at 1.46%, this is the best level we've been on in a couple months since we broke down. And you've got to kind of pay attention to what bond yields are saying, because they do affect virtually every other market. You know, it affects the gold market. Most people wouldn't put those two together, but higher interest rates become a competitive market for something like gold, which has no dividend, right? You make money in gold simply if the price of gold is higher than where you bought it at, and you lose money if it goes down. There's no advantage to long-term holding the way a utility stock may pay you 4% in a dividend. This pays you nothing. So higher interest rates often compete against gold, because people say, hey, if I can get, you know, a guaranteed money versus getting no money holding gold, unless I speculate correctly and it moves higher, I rather, you know, move. And so those interest rates often depress gold. And gold's only down a couple bucks today. But if you look at, you know, the price of gold at 1750-ish versus what the all-time high was from last August, it's, you know, it's a few hundred dollars different. And gold has underperformed virtually every major asset class this year.
Yeah, Rick, well, let's dive into that for just one second further, because obviously there's the narrative that the interest rates would hurt gold, that, you know, gold's not paying a yield, but there's also the higher uptick in inflation. And so when you look at the uptick in inflation, and I'm not talking so much the tips yield, which are kind of Fed has their fat finger on that. I'm looking more at the CPI inflation, those government metrics that come in. We're still in a negative real rate environment. And so people that are holding dollars, a lot of times when we look at dollars, it's measured against the dollar index of other currencies, but they're not really looking at their purchasing power. Their purchasing power is eroding over time because of inflation. So the argument for gold is, hey, at least this is going to hedge some of that with the inflation, because even if you're making 1 or 2%, you're still losing 2 or 3% to inflation. So what do you think of that counter argument about the rising rates being counterbalanced by inflation?
Well, look, you have gold is the type investment that is used and has historically been used as a hedge against inflation, against disaster, against the currency imploding. I think the cryptos have definitely taken money away from those who might have put it into gold. And certainly, if you look at what the return on, you know, let's say, Bitcoin has been in the last 12 months versus gold, you'd be doing a heck of a lot better, despite the fact that Bitcoin is well off its highs. Gold has lost some of that luster. It doesn't particularly hedge against inflation super well. Inflation is creeping higher, but gold is not. So that's not helping. And bond yields moving up doesn't necessarily mean the short end will move up, but because the Fed has also told us, and now we even see how Fed fund futures are trading, and the fact that you've got more Fed governors looking to raise rates in 2022, whereas months ago, Powell was saying it definitely won't happen until 2023. The interest rate environment is something that needs to be, you know, to go back to your original question, you have to look at the interest rate market when you're trading stocks, commodities, currencies. It is often the foundation behind why a lot of movement takes place in these markets. Not certainly not all, but you're not going to see typically, you know, gold trading at the same price if yields are at 1.6 than if yields are at 1%. And if yields go higher, it's going to be more competition for gold. And gold, look at gold stocks. You know, the GDX is now sub $30. That is a really kind of, you know, this thing is on the precipice of falling again. And this right around $30 to, I think, 32-ish was where the seven-year breakout took place last year. So we shouldn't really, if gold stocks are good to own, we really shouldn't be down here. And if we are down here, we shouldn't stay here down. We shouldn't stay here long. This should be a very quick mispricing. Gold stocks should go up. And if they don't, that's a real signal, too, that people are losing their interest in what the value of gold is supposed to mean from a historical basis.
Rick, what do you take away from the stock moves? Because those are the keys that caught my eye. GDX below 30, close of the week below 30. GDXJ at 39. This is also the lowest weekly close in over a year. People say stocks lead the metal, but either way, the stocks have been getting sold off. They are unloved right now, and the close this week is opening up a lot of downside risk. So are you throwing in the towel on gold stocks yet?
I'm not throwing the towel here, and I own some GDX myself, and I have for years. And, you know, it's very easy to kick myself in the rear end now saying how come I didn't sell at 45, and now it's trading at 30. But if you, and this is something your, you know, listeners can do, pull up a GDX monthly chart, go back 10 years, and you'll see that multiple highs took place around 30 to 31-ish, maybe 32-ish, I'm not even, no, probably between 30 and 31. So the fact that we're 29 and high change doesn't spook me. This is the pullback, but this pullback really kind of has to hold. So I'm not throwing in the towel yet, but I can tell you I'm not a happy camper seeing what gold's doing. And it really, if it's going to hold, it should hold somewhere right around here.
All right, so some pretty defined levels there for GDX and GDXJ. Rick, what about cryptos? Because, look, cryptos are in favor for, I think, a lot of the younger investors. But at the tail end of this week, we did get the news out of China that China is declaring transactions in cryptocurrencies illegal. We're seeing weakness at the tail end of the week, but not a complete washout. I think Bitcoin's down about 5, 6%. Ethereum, some of the smaller coins, those are down 10%. So not a total washout, but that whole regulation argument for the bears, well, China's testing that out right now. What's your takeaway?
So if you let's start off with Bitcoin, because that's what most people are going to look at as their proxy for cryptos. A few months ago, when we held down near 30,000 and we got to 20, I think 29 and change, and then we finally shot up in, I think it was late July, we got to the low 50s. When we shot up, and in 1 week we went from, I don't know, 30,000 to 40,000 in a single week, I said that we would create a new trading range that probably ended up being the low 40s to the low 50s. So far, that's panning out. Even this week's low is, I think, 42 and change or something like that. No, I'm looking now. It's 40,000 in futures, 40,085. So just about 41,000. So anywhere down there has some support. Could you get down to the upper 30s? You could. There's Fibonacci retracements, you know, in the upper 30s. And China is saying what they're saying is significant, because if you make transactions illegal in Bitcoin, you are taking away a heck of a lot of reason that people have gotten into Bitcoin for right reasons or wrong reasons, meaning, you know, legal transference of currency versus illegal, which doesn't matter to me at this particular moment, in the sense that whatever reason you got in for, China's saying you can't do that now, at least out of their country. You cannot make transactions in cryptos. That automatically should take a demand away, right? It's demand of, what's the word I'm trying to come up with? Destruction. And the market sold off. It's bounced a little bit. It's still holding the low 40s, where they are now at 42,360 or so, and whatever the front month futures are, I guess probably November or no, I guess October. So it's an issue. If you recall, Corey, because we talked about this back in April or May, I think May, when I was on with you, I said at the time that the April high in Bitcoin was going to last far longer than people wanted to see it last. And, you know, so if it's April and we're in, so that's the fourth month, we're finishing up the ninth month now. So, you know, we've gone almost half a year now with that high still in place. And I think that that hangs around for quite a bit more as this game gets figured out, both in China, whether or not that's going to change, and whether or not any other countries decide to do anything like that. If it is, it's bad news. Basically, you have to play ranges when you play the cryptos. And, you know, it's not for most people to day trade. And but it is fairly technical. Because the fundamentals certainly are difficult to truly grasp. So if you're a good technician and understand range trading and don't worry about every dollar in something like this, I think you can trade it. So I look at it as a trading vehicle. It's something I've got some money myself in Ethereum, and, you know, I'm just holding it. And you know, I was up significantly when it was at $4,000. It's now down to closer to $3,000. So, you know, I just gave back 25% quickly. That's what you have to expect when you trade this. And if you can't handle those type moves, you shouldn't be trading cryptos. It is par for the course.
Exactly. That is cryptos, right? And that's why it sucks some people in, is because of that volatility that really has been around in the cryptos pretty much for their whole lifetime. Rick, we're going to wrap it up here. Some great comments on the markets, and also for all the gold investors, key levels to watch in the gold stocks, as this week did not end well, but it is, as you outlined, a key level for some sort of a bounce or for the gold stocks to hold. And as for cryptos, boy, oh boy, let's see how the market reacts as we progress through the weekend and into next week on the back of that China news. Rick, as always, great having you on the show, buddy. I always look forward to our conversations. I hope you have a great rest of your week, and we'll get you back on next month.
Thanks so much, guys. Have a good one.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And in this segment, Chad and I are chatting with Mike Larson, editor of the Safe Money Report. And Mike, it's actually been a number of weeks since we had you back on the show. And I realize there hasn't been a whole lot of changes within these markets the last couple weeks. Yeah, we've seen some weakness in the U.S. equity markets, but as we're recording this kind of halfway through the day on Thursday, we're also seeing that rebound in markets. So it in no way was a breakdown. Let's start off by talking about the Fed. There were a lot of central banks that are meeting this week, 12 in total. The Fed is really one of the most important to keep an eye on. However, we did get a couple of the smaller central banks tightening their policy, even going through a rate hike or two. The Fed still seems a little ways away from a rate hike, probably a year at least. But what was your takeaway from what was another pretty boring Fed meeting and statement? Mike, what caught your attention?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is a Fed that's obviously trying to avoid the 2013 scenario where even the mere suggestion from Ben Bernanke that something might need to be done in terms of tapering set off the taper tantrum and everything went hog wild and bond yield shot up and there was turmoil in the stock market and so on. I mean, this is a Fed that's tried to not even take baby steps. I guess you'd call them, infant steps. Is that something you want to go with? Not toddler steps, but infant steps. That's what they're trying to do. So they're very, 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 very gradually introducing the idea that, you know, pretty soon, if nothing changes, we are probably going to announce the start of our tapering, or at least the decision that we will, in fact, start tapering. That's what the September meeting was. It was a meeting to say at the next meeting, if nothing changes, we will decide to start the taper. We won't actually start it, but we'll decide to. So then after November, if nothing changes, maybe they start tapering in December, January, February, and so on, and just go forth from there, dial it back, I don't know, $10 billion a month in terms of bond buying from a $120 billion current pace. We'd have to see exactly how it settles out, but that's what they're doing. They did pretty much preset that as the course unless something changes. Of course, we all know that things can change. I mean, if you get a couple lousy jobs reports in here, we get some other numbers that suggest the economy is dialing back a little bit, especially with some of the fiscal aid that the Biden administration trying to push through is seeming to be on ice now, and just getting caught up squabbling in the political arena. You know, those kinds of numbers could calm down a little bit and the Fed could drag this out or push it out and so on. So it's not set in stone, but they did try and, you know, point in that direction. So that's the main thing that's happening there. Still, the message from interest rates is that we're not going to be doing anything there, at least until later in 2022, possibly 2023. The dot plot, which has sort of their best forecasts, which, of course, are always wrong, but they're still, you know, the current thinking of when they might start doing that. They did sort of increase the pace or move forward the pace at which they think they'll start raising rates and the magnitude by which they will. We've talked before. I tend to be pretty skeptical of this Fed's going to be able to do much with rates without it just, you know, having too much of an economic impact, given all the debt piled on the economy, given some of these demographic and structural issues that long term really kind of put the U.S. in the same place that Japan and Europe and some other advanced economies have been for a long time. So in other words, I think even if the Fed were to start hiking next year, which is probably not my case, I don't think they would start until 2023. But even if they were, it'd be very gradual. And this Fed funds rate cycle, I would be shocked if in this cycle the Fed managed to get rates to anything that starts with a 2. I would be not very surprised at all if they couldn't even get rates to anything that starts with a 1. Meaning, you know, they might, yeah, that would be 4 hikes and, you know, that would be the end of that, or three hikes, 3.5, depending on how you want to measure it. I really think that, again, all those longer term forces argue for any Fed hikes to be gradual, to be pretty small in magnitude, and ultimately for the rate cycle to top out at a pretty low level. And that's what we've seen for the last several cycles. Every time the Fed tries to hike rates, it runs out of steam and the economy gets hit at a point lower than the previous cycle. So it's really just not like, you know, there's nothing like the Volcker days in the early 80s where rates just went up and up and up in big chunks and you ended up at 15, 16, 17%. So that's kind of where we're at. And in the post-Fed environment, the market's been all over the map. First, the bond market loved the Fed idea. Then the bond market hated the Fed idea all in the span of 24 hours. First, gold and silver were fine with it. Then gold and silver hated it. First, the stock market had some volatility. Then stocks decided it was fantastic. So kind of like what we see in the wake of any big number, if it comes to like a jobs release or any big event, something like a Fed meeting, the markets have a hard time sort of settling into what does this mean or deciding what this means for the long term. You get a lot of short term volatility. And that's where we're at right now. You know, if you look at stocks, for example, many parts of the equity market started to stall out and weaken behind the scenes as far back as June and July. Market breadth began to weaken, even though the S&P held up because it was dominated by sort of mega cap technology companies that continued to rise. Now we've seen even some of those companies see some volatility again in the last week or two. And it's just a question of, is this just a quick bout of volatility, then we're off to the races, or is it something more? That's kind of an open question at this point, as I see it.
Yeah, Mike, there's a lot of good points there. There's no doubt that we often see these head fakes right after a big data point or after a Fed meeting, and then the markets will turn around and go the exact opposite direction. But to your point, just circling back to the tapering part, I agree with you on the interest rates that they can't really normalize them up to 3%, 4%, 5% without crushing the market. But most market participants and most analysts do believe that the Fed is going to start tapering. So the question I have is, you know, they're doing $120 billion a month in bond purchases right now. If they dialed that back to 90 and then 60 and then 30 and then zero, who do you think the market for the bonds will be? Who will fill that gap that the Fed has been dumping liquidity into? And how will that affect the bond markets?
Well, I think a lot's going to depend on how much additional fiscal spending, infrastructure, social spending, all the stuff the Biden administration wants to do. A lot's going to depend on how much of that gets through Congress. We've seen some of the initial extraordinary rise in borrowed money and resulting spending, part of the pandemic aid, begin to tail off. Things like enhanced unemployment benefits, all the checks and stimulus money that was being directly borrowed and then dumped into people's accounts. A lot of those programs have expired or been dialed back. And now, you know, we're still talking about a lot of stimulus, but we would need, you know, to really ramp up bond issuance. We would need to see, okay, is this $3.5 trillion more coming down the pike? Is the government going to be able to get, even more, again, social type programs, massive infrastructure, that kind of thing? If it's not, and that kind of stuff has been basically caught in sort of negotiating hell for the last few months, if that stalemate continues, then I think the bond market can handle it without rates backing up too much and issuance going through the roof and the Fed not being there to buy it. However, if the Biden administration does get, you know, to the point where a lot of this stuff is passable and they get it through Congress and they have to borrow more to pay for it, and at the same time you've got, you know, lingering inflation concerns, then you're going to have issues. Then the Fed, you know, if they step back as a buyer, it is going to be an open question as to how the, you know, we're going to be able to sell and place all these bonds without the Fed being that demand backstop. I think you're always, to some degree, going to get some foreign bid there, just because many foreign central banks and other institutional buyers just have to buy the U.S. bond market for liquidity because it offers liquidity. And relative to foreign rates, U.S. rates are still relatively attractive, which is hard to imagine. We're talking about a 1.3, 1.4% 10-year. But again, that compares to even lower rates elsewhere in the developed world. So I don't think you're going to see a bond market crash. But I do think you're going to see, again, if a lot of fiscal comes into the pipeline and a lot of the stalemate is broken there, then that's going to be the real catalyst, I think, for a backup in yields. And we just have to watch and see if, see how the political arena shakes out there.
So then, Mike, taking all these cross currents and understanding that, look, investors are looking to individual stocks outside of just the broad averages, even though the broad averages have done pretty well, in all fairness, continuing to bounce and continuing to be a buy the dip opportunity. What sectors have you attracted? Where do you see opportunities that also include kind of that safety component?
Sure. I mean, when it comes to like the safe money, the core portfolio, what I'm always looking for is decent yield. So at least as good as the S&P, up to 4 times the S&P. I'm looking for dividend growth, you know, a strong growth rate over the last 3 years. I'm looking for dividend sustainability. Can these companies, you know, do they have the cash flows coming in that they're able to sustain and maintain these dividends, or are the yields too good to be true? These are a couple of the screens that we run on our entire universe of tracked companies. And we track more than 10,000 U.S. and Canadian companies all the time. Pretty much every day we run that the market's open, we run our model against them. But what I'm finding is that, you know, the kinds of companies that come back passing these screens are in sort of an eclectic mix of sectors. It's not like we saw sort of in 2018, 2019, when we were very late in the economic cycle, even before COVID, and a lot of the names that were showing up were much more defensive, like consumer staples and utilities. Now I'm seeing, you know, some utilities still in there, but I'm seeing REITs. I'm seeing some companies in technology, even some companies in the industrial sector that are coming back and saying, okay, these companies are worth looking at. So it's a little bit more of a mix that I see out there right now. And that's also how I'm playing it for our investors. I'm saying, look, you know, let's have this utility company that's got a good yield, have this industrial company that's got a good yield and some potential going forward. Let's, you know, mix things up a little bit in technology. There's even a few companies that for the tech sector pay pretty decent yields, particularly in things like semiconductors. So there are ways that you can have a safe money approach that is not just in the super boring type companies, but in those that have a little more growth. And again, that's sort of the hodgepodge of companies now, which just kind of tells you that investors, you know, are still pretty bullish. But again, some of that weakness we saw around the edges, some of that narrowing of breath in the summer still needs to fix itself for this to be a true sort of, you know, straightforward, unquestionable bull market. And that's, you know, that's what we had for about a year coming out of the COVID bottom. And then again, this summer, it did start to tail off in a few sectors.
Well, Mike, just speaking of it, things tailing off in a few sectors, my question would be, you know, I understand the idea behind the safe money side of things and having the dividends and getting paid the yield to ride it out in companies that have a good rating in the WISE system. But what do you think about some of the discussion out there that if we do have a slowdown and that things do keep tailing off, that some of these companies may need to reduce their dividends, especially if growth comes to a screeching halt because of another, you know, shutdown in the wintertime or because of more supply chain interruptions, et cetera, or labor shortages? How do you manage the risk even in the dividend stocks to make sure that these are solid companies and are going to be able to keep paying that dividend moving forward?
Sure. Well, you've got to have some sort of, you know, macro and sort of qualitative view of what's going on in the world on top of what the model tells you. I mean, the model is great. It's a compute, you know, looks at all these different variables, but the model can't tell you if the CEO is crooked, and the model can't tell you if a new product is going to be rolled out next month that's going to lead to a huge boost in sales, and the model can't tell you what the Fed's going to do with interest rates and so on. So that's where myself and the other analysts come in and try and say, okay, you know, this is what, you know, your system is telling you is good, but where do you layer that other analysis on top? And right now, I think, again, that's why I've been keeping in the back of my mind what's going on with breath, why I'm really interested to see what happens in the fiscal arena and sort of the pace of this Fed taper, because all of that stuff is going to come into play. You've got to sort of have an idea, you know, over the next 6, 12, 18 months, are we going to have a big additional fiscal push, or is that going to get derailed? Are we going to see a Fed that's more aggressive, or are we going to see one that's more tame in what it does? And I would say it's looking like fiscal is less likely, and it looks like, to me, the Fed will be pretty tame relative to what we've seen in past rate cycles. So that tells me you're still safe with a lot of these companies. You're still in pretty good shape. I don't think interest rates are going to soar, you know, right off the bat and therefore kill all these sectors that traditionally get hit when long-term yields go up. Think REITs and utilities. I also don't think we're going to see, you know, blockbuster enormous growth coming down the pike. So, you know, you don't want the super cyclical stuff. You don't want to be really exposed to that. You want to kind of try and find that happy middle, that fat middle that's doing pretty well for you. And that's, you know, that's where I've been looking.
So, Mike, let's just wrap it up with a quick comment on the precious metals. You already recapped just how volatile they were kind of pre and post Fed meeting. Unfortunately, especially if you look at gold, even silver, the downtrend is continuing. Silver is very close to breaking down out of this year-long range that it's been in, and gold continues to put in lower highs. What's going to drive the metals? What are your thoughts on the precious metals here? Are they finally getting close to a bottom?
Sure. I think that, you know, we still haven't broken the bull market that started in mid-2018. We've had essentially a corrective sideways to down phase for, you know, but gentle. I mean, not any huge collapses for about 12 months now. It's been a year, which is longer than I expected. I'll admit that in terms of how long this correction's running. But I still think, you know, I still think in some cases people are afraid of that. They have that muscle memory, that psychic memory of what happened, you know, in 2012, 2013. 14, when the Fed, you know, really dialed back its taper and then later on hiked, and it's a, you know, really led to a bad, painful situation for gold, silver, and mining shares. I think this is a Fed, and you know, you could substitute in the Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, the ECB, whatever, you know, for the word Fed, and just rotate any of those others in there. I think you're seeing an environment where they all want to be much more accommodative. They want to be much less aggressive in the hiking cycle. Even less aggressive than they were last time, or the time before that, especially. So in that environment, I don't think this is going to be some, you know, horrible negative scenario for precious metals. You just have to run for the hills and so on. But I do think it's certainly been tough to get ahead of the idea that there's going to be at least stalling in that market. And, you know, I think that I'm kind of in a hold pattern. If you had to say, you know, am I a rip-roaring, add more aggressive buyer? No. But am I somebody also is like, oh, geez, I got to sell before the next guy does, and, you know, metals go to, you know, gold goes to 1,500, 1,400. Absolutely not. I'm not in that camp either. So I think that you can kind of bide your time here. If you have a decent allocation, sit with it and look to see if this market can get out of its own way. But again, do I think you need to like really be liquidating because you're afraid of big losses? No, I'm not in that camp either.
All right, Mike, we're going to wrap it up here. Thanks, as always, for taking time on this weekend show and sharing your thoughts. We're going to follow up in another couple weeks, and who knows, maybe it will be a different story for these markets and a different story for metals, but it really does seem like we're just continuing with a lot of these trends that have been in place now for a little while. Mike, thanks, as always, for your time, buddy. We'll chat again in another couple weeks. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
You got it. Thank you.
Welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are going to shift our focus a little bit more towards the precious metals as Shad and I are wrapping up this show with Dave Erfle, founder and editor of the Junior Miner Junkie. Now, Dave, look, we're chatting on Thursday after the market is closed. And as I mentioned, we'll be talking about precious metals, but I want to start with GDX. Now, we don't know where GDX is going to close this week, but as of right now, GDX broke below that 30 level and closed the day below that 30 level, just below it. It's 29.89 where it closed on this Thursday. The important aspect about this is broadly the 30 level, it's even a little bit higher, about 30.64 was pretty key support for GDX because, well, it had bounced off there a couple times, and quite frankly, we're now at levels that we haven't seen really since pre-pandemic, the pre-pandemic washout and then the quick recovery. The problem being, anybody who really bought post-pandemic, unfortunately, at least in GDX, is probably underwater. Just goes to show how long this correction has gone, and now, unfortunately, how deep it has gone. It's about 35% retracement. This, to me, is the key aspect on any of the precious metals charts. Dave, what's your takeaway from this unfortunate, at least right now, short-term breakdown in GDX?
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I've been watching that 30 level for a long time now, expecting it to be tested. And not only do we have a weekly close coming up tomorrow, but we got a quarterly close coming up next week. So it looks to me like GDX is probably heading down to test its 200-week moving average. And there is an open daily gap from March of 2020 around 27. So I wouldn't be surprised to see that filled here on this. And yet the GDX is trading at a price where it peaked in 2016 at below $1,400. So the gold stocks are basically pricing in gold at least heading down to 1550 here, which would be a 50% retracement from the move from 1050 to basically 2100, which was a doubling of the gold price in 4 years. That 1675 level, which is critical support in gold right now, is the 38.2 retracement level of that move. So that's been tested a few times now, three times. So the gold price now looks like it's probably going to head down to test that area. If we lose the 1750 level on a weekly basis here tomorrow, it's not looking good right now for the short to medium term in the gold complex. And also, if you take a look at the silver price, it's been in a reprieve here of late. It tested 22 this week, but it has bounced almost a dollar from that level on its industrial component as risk on has come back into the marketplace. So lots going on, lots of levels to pay attention here as we wrap up the quarter next week.
Well, Dave, you brought up silver there. And so a lot of times in a healthy bull market, we want to see silver and the miners leading gold to the upside. They often lead to the downside. But silver's been a particularly weird one in that it hasn't really broken down all the way for that industrial component that's tied to the general markets. Mm-hmm. But do you believe that if the miners keep breaking down, if we do see a weekly close below 40 on the GDXJ and below 30 on the GDX, that it's just inevitable that silver will break down? Or do you think silver could buck the trend and hold that part of the equation up despite the fact that gold and gold miners are selling off? What do you make of the silver divergence?
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword, Chad. You know, if silver is able to avoid breaking below 22, because, you know, there's a massive amount of stops there at 22. So if the bears are able to force a stop run at 22, you know, it looks like it's probably going to hit $19 to $20 pretty quickly. But besides that, it's like I said, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because for silver to be saved losing that 22 level, I think the stock market needs to continue rising. But in order for generalist investors to come back into the gold sector, they need to see more fear in the stock market and see the stock market rolling over. So I think if the stock market continues to rise here, which I don't think it will, I think it's creating a big top here. I think today's move was a big short covering move because of what the Fed said on Wednesday. But definitely, if you take a look at the gold silver ratio, it's getting toward that 80 level. That's an important level to watch, because it gets back over 80, that'll keep pressure on the entire precious metals complex. So we want to see the gold-silver ratio remain below 80.
Well, if there's the potential for silver to be more tethered to the general stock market and maybe avoid falling off a cliff there below 22, is silver the better place to hide right now in the near term?
No, silver is not a good place to hide when there's a lot of uncertainty in the market, especially right around crash season, which we're in right now. A good place to hide right now is having a large cash position. And I've done that over the past few months. I've built up a pretty large cash position because, you know, if you take a look at the stock market, we all know how overvalued it is. It's gone up for 12 straight years. With everything that's going on in the world, it needs to at least have a decent correction. And I think that's about to take place. And but as far as the silver price is concerned, when you start, if we see some panic selling like we saw on Monday, that would affect gold stocks and silver, because you'd see safe haven money coming into gold and the dollar. Like today, you saw the dollar down big and gold down along with it, because on Monday we saw safe haven money coming into both gold and the dollar. And that was taken back today because of what the Fed said on Wednesday.
So, Dave, you've mentioned a number of times here that building up cash or having a cash position is best in these markets. There's no doubt about that. As stocks broadly have corrected and kept on fading, yes, being in cash does allow you to get in at cheaper prices whenever you decide to get in. But what about those people still holding some juniors? I still hold a lot of juniors here. I did build up a bit of a cash position, but I'm not nearly that active of a trader as you or Shad are. But for those people looking at their portfolio juniors and seeing already that they've pulled back, many of them at least 50% over the last year, they're saying, just how worse could it get for some of these juniors? Should I sell now and then potentially miss that whole capitulation, move higher? What would you have to say to those individuals that still think that they're holding some good juniors, but understanding that, look, the sector broadly is still under pressure?
Yeah, Corey, I'm in the same boat. You know, I still have core holdings in junior positions that I've added to recently. Sure, some of them I added to a bit early, but I'm still up considerably on most of them because I was fortunate enough to buy them before the move really took off in 2020. And I also took a lot of profit off the table in late 2020 and earlier this year. But what I would say is you got to have your own personal rules while you're investing in these things. And, you know, buying them as they're rising is never a good idea. You know, especially if they're rising late in an up leg. A lot of people did that because they came upon this sector, and many of them weren't very familiar with it. As you know, we've had generalist investors have been out of this sector for so long, and they started to come back in 2020. Well, they learned a valuable lesson. A, it's dangerous to trade on margin, and B, it's even more dangerous to chase juniors, especially after they've gone up 3, 4, 5, 6 times. So we all know that it's buying in times like these, when basically gold stocks have gone from being hated in June, July to now investors being basically apathetic about them. They just don't care. And I noticed on a day like today, when you know the GDXJ loses a critical support level at 30, a lot of my juniors barely even traded. And some of them were even up today, and some were not, and most were not down that much because they've already seen tax loss selling destroy a lot of their gains from last year. So basically, what I would tell these people is, you know, you got to have a plan. You know, my plan is take some profit off the table. You know, when a position becomes too large, when it's gone up, so much, at least get your initial investment off the table. And it's because it's easier to hold a gold stock during a correction when you've taken your original investment off the table. And also, you know, you have downside rules. You know, I never average down. I think the term average down is basically is denial for investors who mistime their entry. Sure, I build positions and average into them as they're going lower. But if I have a full position and it's gone down over 20%, I sell it. I sell it for tax loss. And if it's a quality company, and it is a quality company, or I wouldn't have bought it, I'll put it back on my watch list, and I might buy it after 30 days as a wash sale tax loss. So I might get back into it 30 days later, or 60 days later, or when I think either the sector is bottom or the stock is bottom. I've done that in a few positions recently. So you got to always have a plan. That's the main thing. And never panic. You know, I mean, these things are highly volatile. They're very risky, and you trade and you invest accordingly. And that means you got to have a proper set of rules. Everyone has their own set of rules that works for them. It took me a while to get my own set of rules that work for me. And I have a set of rules now that work very well. And they're tested in times like these. And it's just a great time to just get rid of the stocks that are down over 20%. You have full positions in. And also all the stocks to avoid are like early stage drill plays that have not defined a resource. You know, a lot of them are being sold for tax loss. Even if they come out with great drill results, investors are using the news release as a liquidity event to get rid of them. So a good time to get back into stocks is always at the end of tax loss season, which is end of November, early December, which may coincide with a significant bottom in this sector. So, you know, the large cash position that I built up is very excited right now. You know, this is where, you know, multi-baggers are made, buying in markets like this.
Well, Dave, just in listening to that, a couple things come to mind. One is that, you know, you made a good point that you don't want to average down past your full position, but it's of course that other side of the equation. When should I buy if I'm not fully positioned? If I've got a third of a position or a half a position, I don't want to catch the proverbial falling knife, but I also don't want to chase it to the upside when the run's already happening. So how do you figure out where the best place to get positioned in these companies is? Is it a technical level you're watching? Is it a fundamental driver? Do you want to see the whole sector turn, or is it company specific? How do you avoid not catching the falling knife, but also not buying too late when it starts back up, when you do average back into a position to get that full position in place?
Well, Chad, each stock will bottom on its own accord. You know, a bell's not going to ring and all these stocks are going to bottom at once, like they did in March of 2020. You know, we had a V bottom, and pretty much everything bottomed at the same time within a few weeks. know, that I don't see that happening this time, which is a good thing because it gives you time to vet these companies, talk to them. You know, this is a great time to call up companies and talk to them because they're going to want to talk to you. They're starving for investors. So it's giving you a lot of time to vet these companies and make sure you get into the right ones to hold for the next up leg. But it's a combination of things. It's a combination of technical, of valuation to peers, of, you know, if the company has enough cash. You know, I'm not going to touch anything right now unless the stock is cashed up through next year. And also, you know, technically, where did this stock bottom before? At what valuation to its peers is it trading at right now? Because, you know, the things that are being sold for tax loss now mostly are A, stocks that are down on the year. You know, there's a lot of companies that aren't being sold for tax loss right now because there are no losses in the stock this year. So a lot of them are bucking the trend. You know, they're bifurcated. But the stocks that are being sold the most are like, say, an optionality stock. You know, a company is de-risking a project that needs $1,800 gold. You know, those are being sold. Drill plays that do not have a defined resource. You know, a lot of those are being sold, even if they produce, you know, solid drill results. So this is a great time to get a watch list going of stocks you may have missed during the last run up, because you take a look at a company that has maybe come off 50 to 65, 70% since it made a major top in August of 2020. How much did it move up, and how much has it corrected since, and what has the company done since then? Did it raise a bunch of money? You know, the quality companies did. They took advantage of those moves up, and they raised a lot of money. Are they de-risking a high margin project in a safe jurisdiction? Is it large? Is it district scale? You know, a lot of those companies have come off a lot. And those are the ones that I want to be patient in and vet and have on a watch list and scale into. Maybe, you know, maybe once the GDXJ hits 35, I'll start nibbling on a few. Or maybe a company has gotten so cheap that I won't wait for that to happen. It's company specific, basically, is my answer.
Fair enough, Dave. As well as it should be company specific right now, because look, when the market is under pressure, you can get some stocks at really cheap prices, but you do need to know what your time frame is and make sure that you are willing to suffer potentially some more losses, unless you want to play that game of waiting for the market to turn and then moving into it. So, hey, unfortunately, this is not the simplest trading for this sector because you do have to be so cautious right now. But hey, Dave, that's going to wrap up this weekend's edition. Everybody who tuned in, thank you for taking time on this weekend. And also, please go back throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and listen to the company updates that we recorded. We're really focusing still on a lot of companies because, as we just highlighted here, it's important to know which companies or what companies are doing and which companies maybe tick those boxes for you to at least even just put in your kind of shopping list or your watch list. Dave, we'll chat again next week, hopefully on some better news for the resource sector, but still sounds like it's going to take some time for a substantial recovery to come. Dave, thanks as always for your time. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You too, Corey. Thanks a lot.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.